Welcome to My Favorite Mystic, a podcast about the weird and wonderful world of mysticism. I'm AJ Langley, and today I'm joined by Sander Flubergs. He wrote his PhD on the conceptualization of pain in late medieval mysticism and works on sacred dance in contemporary mysticism. He is a dancer, theologian, and choreographer, and today he's here to speak to us about Lutgardis. Sander, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for the invitation. I'm glad we finally can meet and talk about Lutgardis.
It is absolutely always a pleasure to speak with you. Now, as I mentioned, you're here to speak about Lutgardis, but before we get into her, talk to me a little bit about you. How did you find yourself working on mysticism?
Okay, it's a good question because I always feel a bit in the margins or like really in between the academic field and contemporary culture and art. So I am trained as a theologian. And I think during my theology program, my previous supervisor, Rob Vase, he asked me out for a coffee and to talk about mysticism because I was really engaged in his classes. And he also was looking for a new PhD student. And then he asked to see what I wrote before, like my bachelor paper, master thesis. And he said, you don't know mysticism, you don't reference it, but like what you write is kind of mystical. So I was like, oh, well, that's nice. And I was already from the start, I was obsessed by Hadewijch. That's also one of my favorite mystics, but it's nice to put her in relation to Lutgardis. And then from there on, I was like, okay, let's see, let's read the sources. Let me get inspired by these women. And that's why I got to study mysticism from a historical and theological perspective. And then now I would say I would like to use mysticism as my way of doing theology, because mysticism is so rich and there are so many ways of looking at the text, but also through the text. And like, what can they learn us today? And how can we imply the techniques that mystics use in contemporary theology or contemporary art even? So that's what I'm trying to look at now.
I love that you are just accidentally doing mysticism, not referencing it or knowing that that's what you were doing. But it is something to have someone go, hey, did you know you're doing mysticism?
Yeah, Rob told me like, but actually these are themes that Groesbroek also discusses. I'm like, cool. He must be an interesting theologian.
I love that. I mean, I feel like a lot of mysticism scholars find mysticism as a subject accidentally by stumbling onto a text that they become fascinated with or a particular mystic that they just become obsessed with. But I have never had anyone tell me that they had their own mystical interpretations of things pointed out to them. So thank you very much, Rob, for doing that and for enabling me to meet Sander and enabling all of his amazing work. And speaking of your incredible work, as I mentioned in your introduction, you are a dancer and choreographer who also works on and incorporates the works of mystics into your dance. How did these things come together?
Well, I think going back to my first conversations with Rob, with my supervisor, of course, I was already a dancer at the time. I was already making choreography and I was dancing on Hadewijch's text. I was already quite obsessed by Hadewijch. And then we were discussing, okay, what is going to be our point of departure? What are we going to study now? And of course, I wanted to do embodiment and I preferred dance as a study as well. But I think somehow we ended up with the other side of the coin. Let's say we don't study like dance and joy of the body, but we just did pain because it can only go up from there. Like it can only get better. So let's say we just started with pain because it's a very extreme way of embodiment. So in a way, a lot of the themes, the metaphors, the theological thinking is exposed if we talk about pain. And that's what I really liked. So I think studying pain within medieval mysticism, it shows a lot of the problems or the curiosities of the Catholic thinking as well. But in the end, I still work on the same themes. I still work on embodiment. I just use it as a frame of reference. Also historically, if I have to refer to sources within the Catholic tradition, I would prefer to refer to mystics now instead of the big canon of theological thinking. I think that would be more challenging and more curious to do that.
Okay, so studying embodiment makes total sense in combination with dance.
Yes, I think embodiment ties everything together, I would say, because in the end, the mystics, they are the most embodied theologians. Like, I mean, they are the best in this way of doing and performing theology literally. So, and I think that's why they are a kind of inspiration for me. Preparing for this conversation, I was thinking, like, in the end, what does it mean for a theologian to be a choreographer? Like a writer about movement, of inspired by movement. And in a way, that's what mystics do. They can so well translate their embodied experiences to language. In the end, they are like poets, of course, all of them, because they are so well in expressing whatever they go through, which is something that we cannot express at all. But I mean, they really push the boundaries of language. And I would say that's really great theology, because that's what we're supposed to do, I guess.
Amazing. So speaking of inspiration, now is time to get inspired by the woman of the podcast. Can you please tell us a little bit of background information, biographical information about Lutgardis?
Yes. So I will keep it quite brief to just talk about the curious and interesting stuff. Lutgardis is often studied as one of the mulieres religiose, which I defined in my dissertation as the holy women of the Diocese of Liège. So that's more or less the region what we call Belgium today, let's say, of course, with strong ties and connections to Germany as well. So Lutgardis is one of these women, but yet for me, she stands out. She is very intellectual. She's very well trained in theology because she was born in 1182 in Tongeren, which is now also still a city in Flanders. And she was from a noble house, and she therefore was trained already from an early age by beguines. So she was already very schooled. Of course, she could read. She knew her mystical tradition, and she decided to be first a Benedictine nun, where she became abbess or prioress. But then she moved to a Cistercian monastery in the French-speaking part of Belgium, to Amiens, where she stayed for the rest of her life. And this transition from Benedictine to Cistercian was also quite a moment in her life, let's say. Politically, also in Belgium, if it meant from being a Dutch speaker to being in a French community. And it's a bit tragic, but also quite funny from a historical point of view, that the Flemish movement made her the Flemish saint because she didn't want to speak French.
That's fantastic.
So that says a bit about Belgium in the 20th and 21st century, but also about her life and how she moved and in the end became the Cistercian nun, which was the big inspiration of Thomas of Cantimpré. That's her hagiographer. So of course, through Thomas, we know about Lutgardis. So he wrote the Vita, my main source to study her. There's also some Middle Dutch translations of this Vita, and also a kind of impressive iconography about Lutgardis that Guido Hendrik studied, and it was really widespread in Europe, actually. So at the time, she still had quite some impact for being one of the mulieres religiose. So I think that's a bit of her life's background, let's say. But then, of course, there are all the curiosities. These are just the facts, let's say.
So for those who are listening and are unfamiliar with this term, could you tell us a little bit about who the mulieres religiosa were? What kind of women fell under this particular categorization?
Of course, it's a historiographical term because it's not very clear on what some scholars really mean by the term. But I think when I refer to it, it's really about this close-knitted network. So they're not only nuns, like Cistercian nuns, they're also beguines. For example, Christina the Astonishing is also part of this cluster of women. So often they are closely related. They are friends sometimes. So there is like small little connections you can make between those women. I think that's why it's so strong as a cluster to study them, and also the differences, because they might have known each other. Also, the hagiographers are quite well connected and know each other quite well. The texts are in a very decent network. So that's why, for my PhD at least, I call this a kind of like mystical culture, where you have like big mystics who quite stand out in the canon of mysticism in the Low Countries. But then you have these women as well, and texts about them. You have, of course, Beatrice of Nazareth, who is both a saint from whom we have this Vita, but also like a writer herself. And then what I did was also study Exempla as a kind of extra layer where it becomes more popular, devotional. But these women were a very close-knitted network of both beguines and Cistercians, or women that are in between both. That's also something that happens, going from beguine to Cistercian then.
And we're really lucky because we have vitae about so many of these prominent mystical women from this region. Now, when we're talking about Lutgardis, as you mentioned earlier, the main thing we're working with is Thomas of Cantimpré's Vita about Lutgardis. So what kinds of things does he reveal about her and her mystical experiences? What kind of things does he focus on in his description of her life?
Thomas was extremely inspired by her, because the way he portrays her is really like this kind of hero saint, warrior saint almost. So what he did, just to sketch a little the way the Vita is constructed, he used three books. The first book is like a youthy saint. If there would be a bit of asceticism, it's definitely in her younger years. the way she grew and when she was still in the Benedictine monastery. And then there is this second part, which would be something in between. So I never really figured out what that actually would be, like a young saint, but not yet the perfect saint. And then the third part of the book is the perfect life of Lutkaris, where she actually becomes blind, but then again also becomes extremely contemplative. And she always had visions, but I mean, that's when she really got to know the full truth, let's say, or the very close relation to Christ, where they're all looking for at the time, of course. So all these women are known to be literally obsessed by Christ. It's also the 13th century. So I would call it like the age of love. So they all, in a way, work on this bridal mysticism or like express their love for Christ in their all embodied ways. And I think what Lutkardis does is give us a perspective on love that is, for me at least, unique, because what she can do with Christ and God is quite remarkable. Like all of them are more in a submissive role to Christ, to God. So what Lutkardis does, like her bridal mysticism, is almost like God as the obedient husband. She uses almost like emotional manipulation to get things done from God.
I love that. Is it a one-off instance, or is this a repeated theme in the work?
Throughout the complete Vita, Thomas, he is quite consistent in his way of portraying Lutkardis as this woman who has power over God, because they are so connected. So of course you have like this, the foundations of bridal mysticism, and for Lutkardis, something she was known for, also the iconography, is that there is an exchange of hearts. It's rather early in the tradition of this exchange of hearts. But so she has this moment quite early on in her life with Christ. And I think this is the basis of her relationship, but also of her power over Christ. So in this short passage, Christ wants to give her something, because like, of course, she's so great and so saintly and virtuous. And she first asks for healing powers, but then she gets a bit bored and bothered by it, because people just keep asking her to heal them, or like she cannot really focus much on the divine. So then she asks for a kind of exegesis, like a way to understand scripture better, because of course she's still portrayed as a kind of not too intellectual nun, because at the time they had to at least be humble enough. So she gets this way of understanding scripture, but then she would say like, oh, but I should be more humble, I think. So this is also not fine. So she asks for something else, and then she asks for the heart. So she asks for the divine heart and this exchange, and Christ is like, okay, yeah, of course, let's do this. And then I think the very remarkable thing she says is, okay, but you should temper it, because like, if you're going to give your heart to me, it should not be too powerful. I mean, it should be like still within my control. And I think that's where she already shows her cards. Like it's all about the control she has over this love. And I think that's extremely interesting and fascinating.
That is so fascinating, because you're right. We do often see women from this period constructed with reference to the humility topos, and how that makes it seem like they were weak and constantly thinking bad things about themselves, and their relationships with God often do tend to be very dominated by the divine, and there's a lot of withdrawal and pain that comes along with that. So it is really refreshing to see a mystic being completely in control and in charge of that relationship, and that God is going along with it.
Yes, sometimes it almost feels like a soap opera, because it's so like really human. It's a very narrative way of doing theology, but there's a lot of interesting stuff in there.
Is there an aspect of Lutgardis's life or religious practice that you think hasn't really been talked about enough?
Yes, saving the souls from purgatory. Jacques Le Goff wrote about Lutgardis as this purgatorial saint par excellence. So she was the saint that saved most of the souls out of purgatory. She was really the prototype for other saints. But in mainly Dutch-speaking literature about Lutgardis, it was often overlooked, like one of the big scholars of the 20th century of the Rusbroek Genootschap, Reppes. He said, like, I'm not going to look at these apparitions of souls or like this soul saving practice. I'm just going to look at the big visions for her mission. Like, so he neglected that part as not too theological. But I would say, like, if you look at this practice, it becomes, again, very theological. If you really go into the narrative, if you really go into this Vita, you see a depiction of love that is interesting. And it's again, like I said earlier, she's really very much in control, to a point where she really bargains with God. So what you see with other women is that they can save souls, but there is a kind of exchange of pain. So they will have very physical reactions in order to save a soul, like very high fevers, for example, to decrease the pain of purgatorial souls. Of course, you see that a lot in Christina the Astonishing, who is really like more of the performer of this purgatorial pains. But what Lutgardis does, she doesn't have pain. She's not into that. She's like full on emotional blackmail. So what she does is often telling God, like, okay, I think this soul should be saved. And you're like the compassionate. Why are you not saving him or her? And if God is not really doing whatever she thinks was right, she would literally say like, okay, cut me off. I'm done. Like, I don't want your divine love anymore then. And that's really what the text says. If you don't do whatever I think is right, then I don't need this kind of love. And then God gives in up till a point. And it's about Jacques de Vitry.
Okay, how does Jacques de Vitry come into this?
So there is this part in his life where he's very close to sinning, where he didn't really ask for forgiveness, or he was not really asking to get saved or to be redeemed. And yet Lutgardis thought it was her job to actually intervene. So she told God, okay, I know he is not asking for it, but I think you should redeem him. And then again, telling God, okay, if you don't do this, I'm done with this love relationship. So he had to intervene. And then at a later passage in the Vita, you see how Jacques, after his death, goes a few days to purgatory, maybe three or something. But he's not allowed to tell Lutgardis. God asked Jacques not to tell Lutgardis because she would be upset. And that's really how this becomes quite comical. But in a way, it says a lot about, again, her control over this love, this divine love, how it's called in the 13th century. So it's quite impressive that a woman can do this. And also within theology, that this is even possible. It's quite radical, I would say.
There is something here that speaks to modern healthy relationships and the idea of if you are in a relationship with somebody who is not supporting you and not doing what they say they're going to. I mean, God is supposed to be forgiving and compassionate and loving. And so if that's not what she's seeing, if that's not what she's receiving from him, it makes total sense for her to say, well, then I'm done. You know, if you're not going to be who you say that you are and you're not going to show me and the rest of humanity the love and care that we expect and deserve, then we don't need you. She's just holding him to account for the things he says he's going to be. The threats and emotional blackmail are a little bit more iffy, I would say. But generally speaking, the idea that if a relationship is bad, you should leave makes total sense.
Yeah, in a way, she's just playing by the rules. She's just like, okay, these were your rules, right? You were completely into redemption and pain and love were so intertwined and you give your life. Well, let's do it again. Let me, because she also offers her own compassion. In a way, it's Thomas' way of portraying Lutgardis as a very compassionate saint, because that's one of the highlights you have to hit when you want to get sainted, of course. In this time and age, it's really about compassion as a way to combining love and pain in an interesting way. But I think that's where Thomas is really impressed by her, the way she can get into this mystery of how this salvific pain works and how it's related to love and this abundance of love towards others, to her fellow sisters, but actually like everyone at some point. And that's really impressive. It's a kind of imitatio Christi moment where she imitates Christ in going after death to purgatory and hell and also saving souls there. She just takes everyone with her. So that's like a kind of an impressive hero moment at the end of her Vita, where she really shows her power and strength.
The idea that God appears afraid of her wrath if she finds out that Jacques de Vitry had to go to purgatory makes me so happy. Moving into the more practical side of things for a second, do we know about any of her specific religious practices or any asceticism in her life and work?
I think where she is rather different from other women like Ida of Louvain, for example, or again, Christina the Astonishing, Beatrice as well. She isn't really much of an ascetic saint. She's not really into like mortification of the body. She's even very moderate. So she's more close to another Vita that Thomas wrote about John of Contempe. Of course, a man, but also a more intellectual saint. And very much different from Margaret of Ypres or like Christina the Astonishing, where it's more about embodiment, about suffering, about showing suffering on their bodies. They're really just a canvas, like a Veronica. They're really a canvas to show saintly pain and salvific pain. And with her Vita, Thomas actually shows like, okay, but it's even better to be very moderate. You should not do this excessive pain because the body should be stored. It's an instrument that should be used for saintly deeds in the world. There's a passage on that, which is interesting in a time where pain is so much embodied spectacle. So it's mainly like a literary saint, I would say, Lutyatus. So there's not that much asceticism. And it's quite funny again, like passages, for example, where she's fasting, but she does it on bread and beer. So that's quite funny, I would say, if you read it from a contemporary point of view, that you can fast on beer for 7 years. I mean, that's not really the same as what we see with other saints who are very extreme in their asceticism. So there she's a bit different, again, because of her background as a Cistercian nun with quite a lot of intellectual and probably also like kind of political power, because she's from this noble family. She's portrayed in another way than this lay saints, Christina the Astonishing first and Margaret of Ypres, for example. They have very much different socio-economical backgrounds and probably access to mystical knowledge than Lutyatus. There's also this theme that I discuss when I talk about pain, which is persecution and humiliation, which is also a way of imitating Christ in a rather painful way. This is also a theme that is not really that much present in her life, mainly because she's portrayed as such a very strong saint. So she's the one who is just combating demons. She's like this warrior saint. With her virtues, she can destroy all kinds of demons and devils. It's almost like a video game where she's like just this strong female character, and there's not much weakness shown, which is also remarkable, because in most of the Vitae, you really see also this theme where they're actually exiled, or like where they really have to combat people from their own communities. The only thing here is that she doesn't speak French. And even that, they're like, it's easily dealt with by her. It's not really a big thing. And if it's really necessary, Thomas tells us that she can communicate without the language, or she can operate above or in embodied ways. So she doesn't even need the language to really do her saintly duties.
We love a strong female mystic who is allowed to be strong. And I really like that she wasn't that focused on asceticism and pain and being miserable and hated by everybody, and instead it seems like she had quite a nice time of it, just kicking demon ass and letting everybody out of purgatory. And she even got to have a nice relationship with God, which most mystics didn't get to have. So we've focused a little bit now on her active practice, but what kinds of things are we seeing in her visions?
When it comes to her visions, it's storytelling of Thomas's part, I think. There is like this apparitions or like moments where Christ shows himself. The general topic, I would say, within these visions would be the side wound and also the heart. So in the end, again, we are in a clusters of metaphors where you have the heart, the side wound, the embrace. There's a vision where she's embraced by Christ from the cross. So there's this one arm embracing her, the other one is on the cross still. That's also iconographical. It's a tradition still that depicts this. But then she's also directed towards a side wound where she drinks from the blood. So of course, blood is also in this cluster. I would say like these visions are, Thomas describes it as a kind of further knowledge into this dynamics of redemption, pain, love, and how they are intertwined. But it's very graphic, like as a way of like the side wound is literally like the gateway to the heart of Christ. She's really led into this body of Christ going towards the heart. And then you have this exchange of hearts as well. So in a way, what interests me there is how it's embodied knowledge. It's about going through her own body and understanding the body and how it graphically also connects. There are kind of meditations on these visions. I think Rachel Smith talked about Lutyatus as an exegete of her own visions. So there she shows her literacy, that she also understands and deepens her own knowledge based on the visionary activity she has. And it's mainly about, I would say, this heart and the wound. So it's not about imitating the wound. So she doesn't really see the Christ who is bleeding from stigmata, for example, and she doesn't really goes into this mortification or not in this wondrous stigmata showing, but she meditates on it and she gets knowledge from there. So I think that's a bit different than other saints. Again, there she shows how she is more of a mystical theologian, understanding what it is, mystical visions and what they mean, and very much, again, through her embodied knowledge.
Amazing. Now, I know why I now love Lutyatus, because she seems feisty and fun, and I really like her as a character. I'm going to have to go and reread her Vita now. But as you are the guest, and it is the theme of the podcast, as we are coming towards the end, I need to ask you the one final question, which is, why did you choose to speak about Lutyatus today? Why is she your favorite mystic?
I think, yeah, like I showed, she's this kind of boss saint. She's really like this woman in charge. It's just wonderful how she's portrayed as this kind of extremely powerful female character by Thomas in Age. But of course, there was an openness to do this, but still, it takes it a few levels further. And where I think Lutgarde is one of my favorites is because I can put her in opposition to my other favorite, which would be Hadewig, the mystic, also the Low Countries of the 13th century, who is also like this boss woman, like writer. Like she's also extremely radical in her writings. And both of them talk about love and about their divine relationship as a kind of love unity that actually is the source of their theology, but they do it in very different ways. And I think if they would live together and they would see each other, they would be like this arch nemesis. There's friction in their understandings, I would say, because Lutgarde is all about this control over love because she understands the dynamics. But Hadewig also understands the dynamics of love, but she would say, you should never be in control. Like it's love who actually controls God, but also control. It's this divine mechanism. Also a female, because her love is Mine is also a female entity that is in charge, but both have very different perspectives on it. And I think that's what fascinates me. Like just seeing these two women who have probably a lot of charismatic control over their communities, but very different points of view. And I like Lutgarde as one of the Mulieres Religiosas and how she even stands out so much. And I like Hadewig because she's this very powerful mystical writer and mystical theologian. So yeah, that's, I think, why both of them fascinate me so much, because they give us a wide spectrum of understanding of love through very embodied and quite storytelling ways of talking about God as love.
I mean, that was very clearly cheating and sneaking in two favorite mystics for the price of one, but we will take it. Sander, thank you so much for joining me today and for telling me all about Lutgarde.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And thank you all so much for listening. I'm moving into crunch time now with my PhD, so as a little scheduling update, instead of having the episodes come out every 2 weeks, I'm going to be moving down to once a month. So you can expect the next episode to come out on December 1st and the first Thursday of every month going forward. So please join me next time when I speak to Bjorn Schellien about Margarita.